From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
After a full year in office, Barack Obama speaks to the people. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. One day before his first State of the Union address, Barack Obama faces a grim outlook on the economy and the midterm elections. Wall Street's not lending, and unemployment threatens the middle class. The benefits from the stimulus package get less attention than the deficit. The Republican upset in Massachusetts has health care reform on life support, and Democrats from other states are declining to stand for re-election. With his own approval ratings on the decline, can one of America's most gifted orators turn things around? On Reporter's Notebook later on, will France ban the veil for Muslim women in public places? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Just 1 year ago, Democrats were talking about a new political era. Now, President Obama faces a nation of angry voters. We'll set the scene for his first address on the State of the Union. On Reporter's Notebook, a parliamentary committee says that the Muslim face veil represses women and challenges the Republic of France. First, this news update. Another suicide car bomb went off in Baghdad today, killing more than 18 people, injuring some 80 others. It's the second day of high-profile attacks. Jane Arraf is Iraq correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Jane, thanks very much for joining us on our program today. Tell us, if you will, where did this bomb strike?
Central Baghdad, just outside the forensics department of the Interior Ministry. And it's significant not only because it was outside the forensics department, but because it really was the second day in a row of suicide car bombs. And this, as you mentioned, had quite a high death toll. But even more than that, it sent a message to Iraqis and the Iraqi government that they are, again, targets, it seems.
Who were the people killed?
A lot of them were police officers. This was criminal investigations, basically, at the Interior Ministry, and there would have been a lot of police officers there at the time. A lot of others were people who were either killed or injured by flying glass. And one of the things you found, which we found in the hotels yesterday when they were hit by suicide bombs, is that those explosions essentially shatter every piece of glass in a building. So not only glass, but tangled metal goes flying. And we spoke to people outside who had been injured, just sitting in their homes, basically, having breakfast when the glass flew in and hit their children. So a lot of ordinary people, as well as police officers doing their jobs, have been hit in today's bombing.
You report that General Raymond Odierno, the top U.S. general in Iraq, says this is a definitive evidence, or that he has definitive evidence in addition to this, indicating that al-Qaeda in Iraq is transforming itself. Tell us what he means.
What he essentially means is that if you look at these attacks, particularly the ones yesterday, which was a series of coordinated attacks against very high-profile hotels frequented by Westerners, those were in the same vein of being high-profile and against visible targets, but much smaller than the previous ones. And his point is that having gone after government ministries and launched some very effective suicide truck bombings against the foreign ministry, the finance ministry, the justice ministry, they are now shifting their tactics a little bit and going after other targets and using different tactics. Yesterday, for instance, involved gunmen who tried to overpower guards by shooting at them before they drove a suicide truck through the barrier outside a hotel near here. So that's essentially what he means, that they're changing their tactics and basically becoming more creative.
You also indicate that he thinks they're becoming increasingly well-educated and increasingly Iraqi.
One of the things we really thought about the insurgency before the insurgency became aligned and then in a sense, moved into al-Qaeda in Iraq and other affiliated groups, is that this really, the core of this were young people, young disaffected people, nationalists, the jobless, and there's still quite a lot of those. But Odierno's point really was, if you look at the top leadership, it's harder for foreign fighters to come into the country. Syria has cracked down, other countries have cracked down, And increasingly, the leadership here is Iraqi. And increasingly, they're being not only clever in the tactics they're using, but very clever in the way they're financing these attacks. So he says some of them have masters in business administration, so they can track the financing and suicide bombers. Some of them are engineers. And he says they're actually keeping an eye on 5 to 10 people who they believe are responsible for attacks and are gathering information about them, but clearly don't have them yet. So if you listen to, if you talk to Odierno, he will tell you that they are making progress, but if you talk to Iraqis in the street, it's certainly not progress that's fast enough to make them feel safe.
The Shiite-dominated government of Iraq has recently been making things very difficult politically for those who were in the Ba'ath Party, the Sunnis in particular, making it hard for them to run for election. Has that created the kind of discontent that do you think al-Qaeda can capitalize on?
That's a great question, because part of the lure of al-Qaeda and really part of the lure of the insurgency has been, in a sense, this feeling on the part of Sunnis that they have been left out of the future of this country, and they've capitalized on that. What you see in countries around Iraq are Sunnis who left, and they include people who were former Baathists now in the Gulf and other countries, but really ordinary Sunnis, a lot of the Iraqis who have fled the country, fled sectarian violence, and they will tell you that because it's Shia dominated government, obviously not entirely Shia, they don't feel welcome here. Now, that perception may or may not be true, but that is the feeling. But in terms of the election, the prelude to the election, barring these candidates, even though many of them accused of being Baathist are Shia as well as Sunni, actually has deepened that rift between the Sunnis and the Shias. And that's the one thing that the U.S. and Iraqi officials really believe needs to happen to make things more stable. There has to be less of that division. There has to be reconciliation.
Okay. All right, Jane Aroff, apologies to our listeners for the quality of that line, but the information was very important and we stuck with it. Jane Aroff, thanks to you with the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. In a moment, Barack Obama prepares to speak to the people on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. With all that has happened during the past year, it's hard to believe that Barack Obama has yet to deliver his first address on the State of the Union. He's going to take care of that tomorrow. John Mercurio is executive editor of The Hotline. That's the National Journal's daily briefing on politics. And, John, it's always good to have you on our program.
It's great to be here.
Democrats, fellow Democrats, aren't exactly rushing to the president's support at this point. The son of the vice president, Beau Biden, who was expected to run for the vice president's old seat in the Senate in Delaware, is opting out.
Yeah, he's one of the latest Democrats to opt out of what looked like it was going to be a pretty tough race for the Senate. And I think, in particular, Beau Biden was spooked by what happened just a couple of days ago in Massachusetts, where Democrats were urging voters to go to the polls to honor Ted Kennedy, to hold on to the seat that had, of course, belonged to Ted Kennedy for decades. And Beau Biden saw a similar situation, where basically he was going to have to be campaigning in 2010, asking voters to vote for him because of his father. So you really started to see some parallels, I think, in that race that scared him.
We kind of wonder what the Attorney General of the state and the Vice President of the United States chat about over dinner if they can't agree that the son ought to run for the father's seat.
Yeah, it's that race, and you also got a race in New York. That's going to be a big problem that Hillary Clinton used to belong to. She's now in the administration. I think Barack Obama's own seat in Illinois. There'll be a primary there next week where we'll find out more about who's going to be on the playing field this fall. But that race could be in danger again for Democrats. And another one in Colorado that Obama picked off for his Interior Secretary, Ken Salazar, also in danger. You start to see a trend, which was a lot of Democratic confidence last fall, that they could just hold these seats with whoever Democratic governor is appointed, whether it was Colorado, which has been a historically Republican state, but it trended Democrat recently. Suddenly they thought, well, we can pick off the Democratic senator and we can replace him with someone and we can hold the seat. That's obviously, 1 year later, turning out to be a much more difficult challenge.
Illinois, though, much more analogous us to Massachusetts. It's been a blue state for a long time, and we're talking here about the seat now or formerly held by the President of the United States.
And that has a lot to do, I think, with a strong Republican recruiting effort. They were able to get probably their ideal candidate, a moderate Republican Congressman Mark Kirk from the Chicago suburbs, who does have a relatively centrist voting record. He's very affable, very well-liked in his district, and a lot of turmoil on the Democratic side. I mean, sure, it's been a Democratic state for decades, or at least for several years, but everybody in this country probably knows the name Rod Blagojevich, and Republicans this fall, whether Blagojevich is on the ticket, which he won't be, you will hear a lot about him and a lot about the taint that he's placed over his party and the candidates who are on the ticket this fall running for those offices.
Now, the president has brought into the White House for the first time back from the campaign one of the people who helped to put him in the White House. Tell us about that and how important it is that David Plouffe is back in line.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about David Plouffe, who was the campaign manager for the Obama-Biden campaign back in 2008. Very, very, very well-respected Democratic consultant, Democratic strategist. He'd worked previously as the executive director of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, had worked with Democratic Senate candidates as well. So clearly somebody who helped steer a particularly treacherous campaign back in 2008 for Barack Obama from sort of a long shot at the beginning of the campaign straight through the New Hampshire, Iowa, and Democratic primaries and on to victory. So there's a lot of optimism, I think, in Democratic circles that Plouffe, because of his political smarts, will be able to turn things around. He's already put an op-ed in the Washington Post urging sort of a quick and decisive conclusion to this whole campaign for health care reform, asking Democrats to pass a bill. You're seeing that, I think, being one of the major messages coming out of this White House, which is, regardless of what happened in Massachusetts, we need to pass a health care bill. Otherwise, we have to run in November defending the caricature that Republicans have created over the past year on health care, be it death panels, government takeover of the health care industry. All of that will be something Democrats have to defend if they don't have a bill. And I think Plouffe recognizes that, and I think is trying to undertake some sort of remedies.
And in that op-ed piece in the Washington Post, Plouffe indicated that he wants to see health care passed, even though there could be short-term problems if they have to effectively jam it down the throat of the opposition.
And that's the danger, and that's the risk, I think, that Democrats face. I mean, you know, you're talking about different procedures, different budget procedures. Democrats are considering right now reconciliation, which would allow them to forego the whole filibuster process and just pass a health care bill, a rather pared-down health care bill with just 51 votes. You know, in some ways, to Republicans, that's being viewed as the nuclear option, and if you do that, you could really start to see a lot of pushback from Republicans, even more so than we've seen before. The other option is asking the House to pass the Senate bill, which would essentially forego the Senate, the now 59-seat Democratic majority, having to vote on the bill. That could also, I think, cause some backlash among some conservative House members.
What about independent voters around the country who apparently voted in favor of President Obama in part because he was going to change the way Washington works? If, in fact, it takes the kind of manipulation that you're talking about to get health care passed or some version of it passed, what's the impact going to be on them?
Well, I mean, yeah, you've identified the key voting bloc in 2006, 2008. They sided strongly with Democrats in both of those cycles, electing a Barack Obama, but also delivering huge majorities to the House and to the Senate, helping Democrats pick up states and House districts that, you know, they hadn't held in years. And yet they have swung decisively towards the Republicans. They voted for the Republican gubernatorial candidates in New Jersey and Virginia last year. They went strongly for Scott Brown in Massachusetts. All states, New Jersey, Virginia, Massachusetts, that Barack Obama carried last year. And, you know, I mean, I think more than anything, the challenge for Democrats right now is to appeal to independents for patience in terms of the, you know, Barack Obama's promise to change the tone in Washington, for, you know, to try to get Democrats to adopt more bipartisan approaches to their legislative priorities. But also, I think it has a lot to do with process. I mean, you heard Barack Obama talk about this on ABC News yesterday in an interview with Diane Sawyer, where he said he recognized that he'd made a mistake, for example, in not allowing C-SPAN cameras into the health care negotiations. And that was a sort of a small but an important promise that he'd made during the campaign that he reversed himself on, and that what that said to independent voters was that this isn't a new kind of leader. This isn't somebody who's going to allow for transparency in his government. And that, I think, really hurt him with and hurt his party with that key block of voters.
One more question to you. The Republicans are not necessarily in a position to take advantage of all of these problems for the president because they are a divided party.
They're a divided party. You certainly are seeing a lot of different important and fascinating primary campaigns among Republicans where they're certainly showing a lot of their divisions openly. The Florida Senate primary is sort of one of the more notable ones. And yet you are seeing that they are having a lot of success in recruiting. They're recruiting a lot of strong Republican Senate and gubernatorial candidates. And so to that extent, sure, they aren't as popular. They're still unpopular as well. Polls show that, you know, favorable ratings for Republicans are just as low, if not lower, than Democrats on a national scale. But when you go district by district or state by state, race by race, which is what we do here at the Hotline, you really start to get a sense that things are shaping up very well for them in the playing field, the landscape such as it exists. So, I think Republicans have reason at this, you know, still very early stage to be very optimistic about 2010.
Holding their breath, though, that those strong sure. candidates they're recruiting aren't going to be challenged by teabaggers who demand a kind of purity that may not get them through the general election if, in fact, they get nominated.
That's true. That's true. And in some cases, some of these conservative candidates become much weaker general election candidates. I mean, Marco Rubio, as the former state House Speaker, but a very strong conservative in Florida, doesn't poll as strongly in a general election as Charlie Crist, the current governor in
John,
that Senate race.
John Mercurio, always good to talk with you, and thanks a lot for joining us once again.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Executive editor of The Hotline, the National Journal Daily Briefing on Politics. Jonathan Cohn is senior editor at The New Republic. He writes the magazine's The Treatment blog. He's also author of the book Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Jonathan Cohn, good to have you back on our show.
Oh, it's good to be back here.
What do you think about the options here with regard, first of all, to healthcare reform? Do you think tomorrow that the President of the United States will say in his State of the Union message that we got to get health care, even if it takes reconciliation, even if we have to resort to parliamentary maneuvers?
Well, I imagine we'll hear him make some type of statement about how important health care is, how health care is tied to the broader issues facing Americans, in the sense that if Americans are worried about the economy, they should be worried about health care too. And I imagine he will vow to press ahead. I don't know, and in fact I'm slightly skeptical, that we will hear him get into the weeds of how they're going to proceed. I think, as you were discussing before, one of the problems here with health care reform is that people are tired of the process. We've been talking about it for a year. We've watched it play out. We've seen committee hearings. We've listened to interest groups. Everybody is sick to death of it. And while he may want to send some sort of signal about how he wants to proceed, and it would be good to get a signal, I'd be surprised if the rhetoric itself was so explicit as to say, this is how we're going to do it. I expect the rhetoric itself may be a little more vague.
One would expect that. But what about the White House? Is there really a game plan, or does there seem to be some floundering around?
Well, I think certainly last week when the Massachusetts election happened, there seemed to be quite a lot of floundering. It's hard to imagine now looking back, but, you know, as of a week ago today, health care was on the verge of happening. The House had passed its bill. The Senate had passed its bill. They had basically worked out the terms of an agreement between the two houses, and all that remained was to seal that agreement and then have each House of Congress ratify it. Now, because of one changed vote in the Senate, the entire equation changed. And for several days afterwards, I found it rather surprising that there was not a, there didn't seem to be a game plan in place. You could see it Tuesday night as the election returns were coming in. You know, you would have expected the White House at that point to have figured out. I mean, they're in charge here. I mean, they are. You know, Barack Obama is the head of the Democratic Party. He's not just the head of the U.S. government. If the Democrats were going to go ahead, he should have. You would have thought. Had some kind of sense of where to go. What were the talking points going to be? What is the strategy for taking this effort forward? And there wasn't. There were mixed messages coming out of the White House, mixed messages in public, mixed messages in private. If you talk to people on Capitol Hill, all through last week, there was a sense of, well, what does the White House want us to do? And you had various members of the Democratic Party. Each one, it seemed, having a different opinion of how to proceed. Some were saying, well, clearly we need to drop this. And some were saying, no, no one wants us to drop this. We just need to break it up into pieces. And some people were saying, well, no, you can't break it up into pieces. It doesn't work that way. We need to press ahead, but we need to get done with it, and here's how to do it. And I think now it's starting just the last few days, we're starting to get a little more focus, although even now, if you talk to people on Capitol Hill, they will tell you they don't feel like they're getting the hard push from this on the White House that they would like to see.
Even President Obama said it's going to be difficult to break this into pieces because you're all familiar, we've all become familiar with how everything is related in this way. So if you want to provide universal care, you have to then have a mandate for everybody to have insurance. And if you have that, then you get into questions of how the people who can't afford it are going to be able to pay for it and so on. Are you one of those who agrees with, I think, what David Plouffe said in his op-ed page in the editorial piece in the Washington Post, that it's time to get this done, even if there is some short-term political disadvantage by virtue of having to use procedural manipulations to do it?
Well, yes. I mean, I would, and let's be clear, when we talk about procedural manipulations, and I've heard that already, that if let's take a step back and explain what we're talking about here is that
the reconciliation.
Right. I mean, what needs to happen at this point is the Senate has passed a bill, the House has passed a bill. They were going to rewrite the bill to get some kind of middle ground, and then each House pass it again. If you do that, though, the Republicans would have a chance to filibuster it. A filibuster is blocking a vote. And so you would need 60 votes to overcome that. Remember, the Democrats still, even with Scott Brown, they have 59 seats. They have an overwhelming majority. But, you know, they're one short of that magic 60 would take to break this filibuster. So the new plan is, well, all right, the Senate has passed a bill, the House has passed a bill. They're not that different. So let's have the House just pass the Senate bill as it's written. And once that happens, that bill is ready to go to the president. It's done. And then come back and try to fix it and make some of the changes that the House wanted and, frankly, that I would want. And you can do most of these changes through what's known as the budget reconciliation process. Now, again, to be very clear, you know, critics say, "Oh, this is a end around. This is a manipulation of the process." Well, not at all. It's been used many times in the past. It was used for the 1996 welfare law. The Bush tax cuts passed in the reconciliation process. There are some limits to what you can do in reconciliation, but it so happens that most of the changes we are talking about, the improvements we'd like to make to this bill, would actually fall into that category.
Okay, hold that thought. We need to take a brief break, which we will do. We'll come back and return to this conversation with Jonathan Cohn and others as well. On Reporter's Notebook, will the French ban the Muslim face veil in public places? Back in a moment with To the Point for PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, to talking about the upcoming State of the Union address, the first, believe it or not, by President Obama. He's only been in office for 1 year, and we're talking about the situation that he faces as he prepares to address the nation. Philip Klein is Washington correspondent for The American Spectator. That's a conservative magazine, as opposed to Jonathan Cohn's more liberal New Republic. And Philip Klein, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What about this regard? Let's start with health care reform and the allegations that the Republicans will reign all over the Democrats if they try to get by the filibuster with reconciliation or some other kind of a procedural arrangement. Will that happen?
Yes, I mean, I think that let's keep in mind why the Democrats scrambled so hard last year to get to 60 votes. The reason was that the things that you could do through reconciliation were limited. It's a very messy process, and Democrats didn't think that they could win the PR fight over the use of reconciliation, which is an incredibly partisan maneuver. So basically what you're saying is that now, after the Massachusetts special election, which people argue about, but one thing's clear is that independents are fed up with the intensely partisan nature of this whole idea of ramming something down our throats and this idea of backroom deals. So now, after this election, you're going to go back and use a process that was too hot and explosive to use last year before this electoral result. On top of that, what would be in this reconciliation bill? Well, the idea is that, you know, John Conant spoke about the differences and the problems that some liberal House members have with the Senate bill as is. And the biggest problem is this so-called Cadillac tax, which affects benefit-rich health plans, and that unions were really upset because it would affect a lot of union benefits. So the White House and negotiated this deal with Democrats in the House and the Senate and unions to basically exempt unions for the first several years from this tax. So it would create two tax systems, one for the unions, which happen to spend 90% to Democratic campaigns, and it would create another tax system for everybody else who isn't in a union. So the idea that they're going to use this intensely partisan reconciliation process to ram through a $60 billion payoff to their union allies, I do not think would look very good in the wake of what happened in Massachusetts.
Do you think, Philip Klein, that the president was right when he told Diane Sawyer that he made a mistake by not letting the C-SPAN cameras come into the negotiations when he and the others were working on health care?
Well, I think it was. I mean, I think the real mistake was sort of promising it in the first place, because it's one of those things where obviously you're going to have a sort of big bill with hundreds of billions of dollars of money going around. There's going to be deals and negotiations. I think it was kind of naive of Obama to promise that in the first place. However, the reality is that he did make that promise, and that promise and other promises like that were essential to Obama's appeal to independents. Obama was able to get liberals and independents to both vote for him and be excited about him. And the way he was able to win over independents, who may not have been totally on board with him ideologically, was the sense that he was going to change Washington. He was going to end these cynical backroom deals. And yet Obama has made backroom deals with the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, the health care bill that we're ended up with, you know, it had this special deal to exempt Nebraska from the paying the expanded Medicaid financing that every other state would have to pay. It had this special deal with the unions where he, you know, and part of this he was trying to pass the buck and say, well, it's Congress's purview as to whether they want to have C-SPAN in. But the deal he struck with unions was in the White House. He could have let C-SPAN cameras in. So, yes, I think that sort of undermines the, you know, the credibility among independents, and it also makes people suspicious. Well, what is he afraid of us seeing?
Philip Klein, again, Washington correspondent for the American Spectator magazine. Jonathan Cohn, back to you with the New Republic. Do the Democrats really have a choice, having committed as much time and effort and all of these arrangements and deals as they have to health care reform?
Well, I think they don't have a choice. I've been arguing that for a while. And again, I always sort of, when I sort of do political prognosticating, I always sort of put the caveat in there that, you know, I think we're all guessing about politics. I feel much more comfortable predicting what will happen in terms of, you know, a policy question. But my sense certainly has been Democrats are going to be attacked on health care reform, period. Most of them voted for either the House or the Senate bill when it came through their chambers already. The difference between passing the bill and letting it die is the difference between having an ad run against you that says, you voted for that awful health care bill that passed, and you voted for that awful health care bill that almost
pass. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that ad, those ads are about equally potent. But if you pass the bill, you have something to run on, and you can remind people that the bill you passed provides lots of things that the polls show consistently people like, and many of those benefits will start to appear in the first year. You can say, look, kids coming out of college can stay on their parents' policies longer. If you're considered uninsurable by the insurance industry, we're going to get you right away some kind of stopgap plan that can at least cover your catastrophic illnesses, and then in 3 years you'll be able to buy a regular full benefits plan. We're on our way to providing access to everybody for insurance. The donut hole for senior citizens is going to start to close. We're putting money into training new nurses and new doctors. That's a lot to run on. These are good things. Frankly, if I'm a Democrat, I'm looking at running an election in the fall. I'd much rather go into the election being able to point to these accomplishments, to say, look, this is what I did. And by the way, Republicans who are against this, do you want to repeal this law? I'm sorry, do you want to go back to a time when an insurance company can deny you coverage because you happen to have survived cancer 7 years ago? I don't think Republicans are going to want to run against that. So if I'm a Democrat, I'm going to be running for Congress. I would much rather have that accomplishment to my name rather than nothing and be still getting hit with the same ads.
Jonathan Cohn, again, senior editor at The New Republic. Thanks a lot for being on our program today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Philip Klein, back to you with the American Spectator magazine. That takes us into the question of the economy. The president keeps making the connection between health care and the economy, and that argument carries a lot of weight, certainly, as you indicated yourself, with independence. Isn't that what he's really going to have to address tomorrow in his State of the Union message? And what do you expect to hear from him?
Yes, I imagine that he's going to talk about the economy, and we already know that he's going to announce a proposed deficit freeze, too. But I think this, I just wanted to, if I could quickly respond to this idea of whether Democrats are better off passing something. I think you have to make a distinction between what may be better or look better for the Democratic Party as a whole, and what might be better for individual Democrats running in specific districts. And 39 Democrats have already voted against the House health care bill. So they could vote against it again and say, be consistent and say, look, if the Republicans want to run an ad against them, they could say, look, I bucked my party and I voted against the health care bill. Another 41 Democrats voted for the Stupak Amendment, which bars federal funding for abortion in the health care bill. Any of those people can say, look, the version of the health care bill I voted for bars federal funding from abortion. And once the party changed that and went back on that, and we no longer have those restrictions on abortion funding, I didn't vote for the bill. And so I think this idea that, well, you know, yeah, since for some Democrats it might be better to have something passed, but there are a lot of people who would be much better off if it failed. So I think, you know, in terms of the economy, and, you know, there's a lot of talk last year about, you know, Jim DeMint saying that health care, you know, if that fails, it's Obama's Waterloo. I think if I'm Obama in the White House, I have to think about, well, how do I make this my Dunkirk? How do I basically, you know, pull out and salvage as much as I possibly can to live to fight another day? And I think that that's what he's going to have to do. It's not going to be easy in the short term because a lot of liberals are going to be upset, but I think that now he has to become this sort of independent, more independent-minded president that people elected if they're going to have a chance to sort of limit their losses this November.
Philip Klein, again, Washington correspondent for the American Spectator magazine. Tom Schaller is professor of political science at the University of Maryland. He's a contributor to the polling and political blog 538.com. And Tom Schaller, it's good to have you back on our show.
Great to be back, Warren.
What's your take on health care reform? We can't get past that as we try to discuss the State of the Union address. May not all be involved with that, and we certainly want to talk about the economy, but it might be a loser for a lot of Democrats. Isn't there a real chance that they could try and fail?
Well, I think they have tried, and I suppose they have failed in large part because Republicans and conservatives have proven once again that they know how to obstruct the policy process and the political process, and they know how to foot drag and delay and throw up all sorts of complaints. I mean, I find it ironic that Mr. Klein you know, complains about backroom deals like the Louisiana Purchase, which, you know, nobody wants those sort of $100 million bargains to be part of a legislative process, but it's hardly the first time that votes have been traded for home state favors. And the Nebraska exemption, it was actually an exemption given to Ben Nelson in exchange for him backing down on abortion, which is the kind of issue that conservatives and Republicans are complaining about.
But the president did promise those cameras, those C-SPAN cameras, in on the negotiations.
I think that's a fair enough point. I think that's a fair enough point. I mean, I just, you know, we talk about $100 million in a multi-billion-dollar bill. It's a very small fraction. And obviously, we'd like prefer to not have to add $100 million more to the federal deficit. But there were lots of bargains cut during the Bush tax cuts, which cost us $1.12 trillion in lost revenues, which is the equivalent of 12,000 Louisiana purchases for Mary Landrieu. So the scale of this is, there's a mountains made out of molehill effect here. And then in terms of the politics of it, I think it's easier to block, it's easier to obstruct. I think the Obama administration, the Democrats, underestimated just how much 60 votes in the Senate and about 59% of the House seats really carries when you're going to do something non-incremental. I mean, the political system and certainly the partisan overlay onto that system is designed to thwart change and non-incremental change in particular. And those majorities, particularly when you're trying to make a progressive change, the supermajority threshold is much higher, I think, for the left and the center-left and for Democrats more generally than it is on the right. Bush was able to get things done with far smaller majorities and, by the way, less obstructionism. The use of the filibuster in the last 3 years has doubled compared to the 6 years when the Democrats were in the minority of the Senate and Bush was the president in his first 6 years. So, it was clear what DeMint wanted to do. They wanted to stall and foot drag and hope that something bad would happen, and Scott Brown happened. And so I think the Republicans played their cards perfectly. I'm not criticizing them from a political standpoint. The question is whether the country is going to be the better or the worse for it.
Let me ask you this. In the context of the president delivering his first State of the Union address under the circumstances that we have been discussing, you've just written today and I think you began to elucidate this idea a minute ago, that a supermajority is needed to govern from the center left, whereas a simple majority or even a minority is capable of governing from the center right. If that is in fact the case, then what does the president, or what should the president be talking about tomorrow? If health care was too much to take on in the first year, if it's all the economy stupid, are those the things that he should, is that the thing he should concentrate on?
Well, I think Obama's failure is not focusing on the economy first. I remember before he became president during the transition, I suggested that he should have done something different to prove his governing skills, picked a different policy area like energy, particularly a policy area that's quote-unquote considered a conservative or Republican themed policy areas, much in the way that Bush went after education with No Child Left Behind. Whatever you think of the policy, it was a way of sort of playing in the other team's playing field to demonstrate that you get something done. And I think if Obama had tackled energy, cap and trade being part of it but not all of it, a comprehensive energy program, it would have been much harder to push back on him on that, particularly with dependence on foreign oil, get that victory and then go for health care after you've built some momentum as opposed to rolling all the dice on health care.
So what does he do now?
Well, now this is where he's stuck, is because he's gone after health care, and now you've got all these people abandoning because of the swing of one Senate seat, which seems a bit of overdramatic. I think Obama should show a little bit of strength tomorrow night and show that he's not going to buckle under rather than this superficial across-the-board budget freeze, which I think is mostly just cakes and circuses for a public that tends to think, unfortunately, that you can solve our budget deficits by eliminating John McCain's earmarks of $30 billion a year. I mean, there's a significant problem in the fact that most of the American public, frankly, doesn't understand how the budget works and where everything goes and how much is spent and where it's raised from. And, that's why we can have the public obsessing in Tea Parties about $100 million Mary Landrieu Louisiana purchase deal, as opposed to the $7 trillion in lost efficiency to the economy if we don't do anything about
okay.
$7 trillion.
Tom Scheller, again, a professor of political science at the University of Maryland. Back to Philip Klein at the American Spectator. Is it your greatest fear that the president will show strength, will begin to act tough, will particularly on the economy begin to address specific issues that people can really understand?
Look, I believe in the sort of the best policies. If Obama, abandoned health care reform, and it worked out better, it worked out worse for Republicans, then I'd be happy, because I think that his proposals for health care wouldn't represent real reform, and they'd have negative consequences for the country. But if I could just respond to one thing Mr. Schaller said, I find it ironic that he's taught his argument in defense of the sort of Nebraska deal and the Louisiana deal amounts to, well, Bush did it. Because I seem to remember Obama running an entire campaign against Bush and against the way that Bush had done things. And the whole idea was that he was supposed to do something different, that, you know, Bush sort of negotiated, let the energy companies write the energy bill and so forth. That was a major criticism of Bush from Obama. And the idea that now that he's cutting all of these deals and the best that liberals can argue is Bush did it too is completely absurd. And
Tom Schaller, your response.
Well, first of all, it's mostly
quickly, if you will. We're running short of time.
It's conservative Democrats who held up the bill. So all the feints that Obama did were in order to placate or appease conservative Democrats. And, you know, Obama, for all his rhetoric, can't just abolish the U.S. Senate, which, you know, of course, gives disproportionate power to a numerical minority in the country. In fact, even when the Democrats were the minority during the Bush years, their states actually represented more people than the Republican majority. So I guess it's sort of beyond the Superman powers of Barack Obama to abolish an institution that's established in Article 1 of the Constitution. I'll grant that point. But, you know, again, for all the talk about efficiency and waste, I point Mr. Klein to the Milken Institute estimate study from a few years ago. $7 trillion in lost income, GDP to the country, because of sick and people who come to work, either sick or don't show up for work. And we're going to lose $7 trillion to our economy for a $100 million deal for Mary Landrieu. I think that's a fair trade-off, frankly, dollar
okay,
for dollar.
Okay, Philip Klein, your response, and maybe we can get to the economy. Maybe we won't have time. Go ahead.
Well, the thing is that if you look at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which actually tracks national health care expenditures, they've done an analysis of all the health care bills presented by Democrats, and they found that all of them would actually increase health care spending as a percentage of GDP. So this idea that we need to pass the health care bill because it will save all this cost to the economy is false. In fact, the reverse is true. It will cost us more.
What do you think, Philip Klein, that the president ought to do? What would be the best policies that you could imagine on the economy, if you can express that in the very brief time we have left? Go ahead.
I think I've said all along, back when the stimulus was being considered, that I think a payroll tax is the best thing, because it's paid both by – it both puts money cutting the payroll tax would put money back in the hands of the middle class, and at the same time – it would reduce the cost of businesses to hire more people and to keep employing more people. So I've said all along that a payroll tax, it's not a tax cut for the rich. It's borne disproportionately by the middle class. You cut that, and it's also paid by businesses. So it'll make it easier for businesses to keep up their employment.
Tom Schaller, would that appeal to some Democrats?
A lot of Democrats. I agree completely. The payroll tax is the only tax in America that never comes under discussion for tax cutting. In fact, I found that most Americans don't understand the difference between the income tax and the payroll tax, which has steadily risen from the FDR days of 1% to the 12% that it is today. Just, you know, so I think there could be a bipartisan consensus or a liberal conservative consensus on cutting the payroll tax. But, you know, you didn't hear much about that over the last 8 years in terms of, who got the disproportionate benefit of the income tax cuts that we had during the Bush
era. Philip Klein, what about the deficit?
Well, I think that there's a lot of spending that needs to be reduced, I think, in a lot of different areas. I mean, Obama's talking about, more spending on this other jobs bill that he wants, even though the $800 billion stimulus bill that he produced has failed to produce jobs. So, I think that there are plenty of ways in a $3.6 trillion budget that you could reduce in spending.
Okay. Tom Schaller, has the stimulus failed, or has it just not yet taken effect completely?
I'm sort of with Paul Krugman. I think it was too little, and it was actually a lot of it's delayed. And so people who are complaining now that the stimulus hasn't worked, I mean, I guess they're right because it wasn't front-loaded or it wasn't enough. But we got very clear signals from conservative Democrats and some Republicans in Congress that they weren't going to go over about $800 billion. So Obama couldn't get the $1.2 trillion he wanted initially. So, you know, I think the verdict is out on that. I think Obama shoulders the burden and blame if the monies were sent for the out years instead of the immediate first year of office.
All right. Well, thank you both for being with us. Tom Schaller, again, professor of political science, University of Maryland, contributor to 538.com, a polling and political blog. Philip Klein, Washington correspondent for the American Spectator magazine. Thanks also to Jonathan Cohn with the New Republic and John Mercurio with the Hotline. Good to have all of you with us today, and we'll see what the president has to say tomorrow. Women who wear the Islamic face veil are a challenge to the Republic of France. That's a conclusion of a parliamentary committee which has recommended a ban in hospitals, in schools, government offices, and on public transportation. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The recommendation against Muslim veils is the product of months of debate and a 200-page report, even though veils themselves are worn only by an estimated 1,900 women in France. Ben Hall reports from Paris for the Financial Times. And Ben Hall, good to have you on our program.
Hello.
Is it likely that this will pass and go into effect in France?
I think there is very broad political support for some kind of either parliamentary resolution condemning the burqa or, as some people would like to go much further and actually introduce an outright ban in public spaces enforceable by fines. I think the government is likely to back the conclusions of this report because it actually provides quite a nice middle ground. It's not a complete ban in all public spaces, but it's more than just a non-binding resolution condemning the face veil. So I think it does have quite a good chance, yes.
Well, what happened to liberty, equality, as well as fraternity in France? My French accent is terrible, and I won't attempt it. But liberty and equality, would sound to me, aren't really part of this if they're going to tell Muslim women they can't wear headscarves if they want to.
Well, I think the idea of telling people what they can wear is essentially anathema to people in Anglo-Saxon political cultures where personal freedom and individual liberty are really the kind of some of the founding, some of the cornerstones of our political culture. But in France, things aren't like that. And perhaps it goes back to, you know, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the 18th century philosopher who said that people had to be forced to be free. The fact is, in France, the most important value of those three is probably equality, liberty, equality, fraternity. It's probably equality and this sort of republican ideal that people are equal before the law. And essentially, the reason that there is so much support for banning the face veil is because many people in this country, even some moderate Muslims, regard the burqa or the niqab or the face veil as an affront to republican values and as a symbol of repression, as a sort of if you like, something that runs completely counter to the idea of the idea that everybody should be treated equally, because they see it as a way of forcing women to or as a symbol of female oppression, essentially.
Aren't there women, though, that say they want to wear the veil, what about them? Do they not have an equal right to do so?
There are women who say that, and there are some of the, I think, a small minority of Muslims who wear the face veil are converts, white converts, we might say, and they've clearly made a choice. But I think the prevailing view in France amongst political elites is that women are not really making a choice of wearing the burqa, are not really making a free choice to wear the burqa. And there may be some legitimate concern because 10, 15 years ago, the burqa was very, very rare occurrence on French streets, and it's become more so, particularly in some of those suburbs, poorer suburbs, where poorer immigrant suburbs, essentially, of France. And I think it's the fact that you've suddenly seen more burqas and more face veils that has worried some political leaders here. They see it as a sign of the spread of Salafism or a kind of fundamental Islam, which never used to have a place in France, and I think they find it as a worrying sign that they want to try and combat.
Is this related to the ban on the building of minarets in Switzerland? Are Europeans in general fearful that their Muslim populations are growing too fast?
Well, I think it would be naive to think that there isn't some Islamophobia involved, or that some people aren't drawn to the idea of a burqa ban because they are worried about generally the spread of Islam. But I think there's a very big distinction between Switzerland and France, which is in Switzerland the ban on minarets was being pushed by an extremist or populist right-wing party, whereas in France there is quite a lot of support across the political spectrum for the idea of a ban, even on the left. But so I think there is quite a big difference there. France is home to Europe's largest Muslim community. There is a sort of concern about French national identity, in an age of mass immigration. I'm sure that the idea of banning a burqa is partly about trying to establish an acceptable form of moderate Islam that people feel comfortable with. But I think in France, liberal, well-meaning, educated people would think that that's probably a good idea.
Ben Hall, Financial Times Paris correspondent. Good to talk with you, and thanks again.
You're welcome.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Sonia Geis and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. Email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/to the point. I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.